Hey, hello. Welcome to the Traveling Farm Museum. In this podcast series, artist collective The Outsiders take you on a journey of discovery along remnants and new developments in the field of ecology, agriculture and heritage in and around Leidse Rijn, Utrecht. Where 30 years ago the cows were grazing in the meadows, now the largest suburban neighborhood in the Netherlands is where more than 80,000 people have found their home. In this podcast series, we bring together different voices of farmers, artists, and residents to reflect on our local food system and culture.
Hello everyone, my name is Chel, and today we are visiting the kombucha mistress Grace Lostia at a cultural center in Utrecht named Moira. We will ask her about her fermented, lightly effervescent drink, which is commonly consumed for its purported health benefits. She will explain to us how she got in touch with kombucha, what does it mean for her to make this beverage, and hopefully she will give us some instructions how we could do it ourselves at home. Be ready to listen to her kombucha orchestra, the story of a forgotten skill. Hello, Grace.
Hello, guys. How really are nice to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, I was curious about how did you start your kombucha project?
Yeah, that's a nice, good question. Of course, it didn't start as a project, really. It was more a curious encounter. Some years ago, I think around 5 years ago, I was just visiting some friends in a squat here in Utrecht, and one of them had this very strange creature floating in a jar and brewing some tea. And then, yeah, we started talking about it, had a taste, and yeah, pretty much fell in love with it and decided to start my first batch. And I never got out of it, so to speak. So since then, it became kind of a project with its own rhythm, and I still do it regularly. Mm-hmm. So 5 years ago, yes.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel after 5 years of doing this? Did it change something in your life?
Well, it definitely took a very random but also beautiful direction, let's say. So in the beginning, of course, it was mostly brewing to observe how it works. And as I was already into fermented food, kombucha is something totally new to me and to my, let's say, culinary, culturally fermented background, because I come from Italy and kombucha come from Asia, supposedly somewhere between Korea and Japan. So I was not really familiar with this special kind of fermentation, which is a collaboration between bacteria and yeast. So it's pretty far from what I was familiar with, which is lacto-fermented food or wine, yeah. Beer, cheese, mm-hmm. yogurt, pickles. So, yeah, I really got my curiosity. And then by observing it and trying to find ways to learn more or literally get rid of surplus, because it's a very rich, generous kind of fermented food, drink, that you produce a lot of mothers, a lot of starter, and you have to figure out ways to, you know, what do I do with this? Mm-hmm. Does it go to waste? Can I share it with people? Mm. And then the whole sharing practice kind of became the direction of kombucha, so a way to meet people, and somehow build a community-based on this exchange.
Mm.
So the kombucha scoby, so the mother, let's say, this rubbery disc that runs the fermentation, start traveling.
Wow, and, that's...
Yeah, that's the state now, let's say.
That sounds pretty much like the traveling Far Museum of Forgotten Skills.
Yes, yes.
But then it yes. could be forum.
For sure, it travels more than I do right yeah. now, the scoby. So it's a very autonomous creature, mm. a very autonomous ferment travels.
Maybe for the listeners that doesn't know exactly what kombucha is, mm. could you give us a easy explanation of it?
Yeah, I mean, kombucha is, in simple words, it's a tonic beverage that has as a... starting base sweetened tea, and then the sweetened tea it's fermented by rubbery disc that looks literally like a floating jelly mushroom kind of thing, composed by bacteria and yeast. So they basically feed on this sweetened tea and turn it into a bubbly tonic effervescent beverage that has also a lot of health benefits, and that's how most, I think, a lot of people know it for the probiotic and prebiotic health benefits. And right now became really, it exploded a hip thing. You can find it everywhere in shops and supermarkets, and most people drink it as an alcohol-free, freezy drink. But, of course, it's not the same as brewing it at home and preserving all of the good stuff in it, let's say.
You mentioned before once to me that supermarket kombucha and homemade kombucha are totally different or totally not... That doesn't have the same properties.
No. And this, I think, is one of the stories you might have encountered with the forgotten skill and food-related research you have done with the Traveling Farm Museum. When you produce something yourself, especially if you don't go through pasteurization, which is the process that preserve a product and give shelf life by killing whatever it's alive in it.
Mm.
So all the bacteria and yeast in this case. When you produce it at home, you actually are preserving that because you don't upscale the production. So you make sure that what you brew stays intact and you are not drinking, let's say, it's a bit blunt, but a dead drink. Or you are not eating a dead food. You are eating something that it's alive, it's still fermenting, will transform with time. So you basically make it, consume it, make it, share it, but it's not supposed to last just forever on a shelf.
So for instance, this kombucha that I'm now drinking, how old is it?
This is a brew from 2 weeks ago, which I made with beetroot and sage and hibiscus. So in these 2 weeks, of course, the color and the flavor have changed much. So it got more bubbly, slightly more acidic, still pleasant, I guess.
It is very pleasant.
Because you are still drinking it. But it's 2 weeks old, and of course...
So how long can it last?
I kept it in the fridge, which extend the life of it. But let's say it depends when you harvest the brew. If you harvest it on the sweet side, it lasts longer because there is still sugars to be... to feed the bacteria and the yeast. If you harvest it sour, then it lasts less. So it gets very acidic very fast, even in 3 days, if you keep it out of the fridge. So it's something you learn as you brew, let's
say.
Well,
it sounds like there is no one same kombucha. Like
That's something that I think it's one of the aspects of fermentation that, well, at least for me, speak for myself, are the most interesting. It's really difficult to produce, to make or to brew two times in a row exactly the same brew. Of course, you have some basic rules, you know, like the famous rhythm I was mentioning before, that if you follow it, you can have a consistent flavor, but it's never the same. And already changing the place where you brew, the hands that brew, the season when you brew, it the same recipe can have a slightly different, look or bubbliness or taste.
Mm. Hey, well, I don't know if you want me to mention this, but I want to tell the listeners that you are a friend of mine, and I met you in Utrecht, but actually your roots are somewhere else.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you often talk about your grandmother, if your grandmother has had an influence on your way of living or the reason you are now at this moment brewing kombucha or fermenting any...
Anything. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Yesterday, I spent the whole day just taking care of, what I think I see as taking care of myself, as in fermenting pretty much throughout the day. And I was making some preparation with quaper. Queens, which is for sure one of my favorite autumn fruits, and not because it's specifically delicious when you eat it raw, but because for me it's kind of a traveling machine. It's strictly connected to my grandmother, and this is to say that she definitely has a strong influence on how I grew up, surrounded by jars and preserved food and pickles and walks in nature, foraging things and then transforming them at home so that we could taste them months later. And yesterday I really thought of her a lot because of the queens. So I was making some syrups and some queens candies, thinking about her. So... Yes, we had it very much in the family, not only from my grandma, but also from my uncle. He has a farm, so he makes cheese, he makes wine. Mm. So there is quite some fermentation going on there. And more than the technique of fermentation, it's really the idea of reclaiming food at home. So I would say not kilometers, zero kilometers, but like 0 centimeters sometimes. You really just don't move from your piece of land. And this is the practice that I like to think more of as the lineage I carry every time I'm in the kitchen preparing something, sterilizing a jar or giving as a birthday present something that I fermented to a friend, because these are all things I've seen happening at home many times. So there is, grandma is there for sure in this practice,
I'm glad your grandma is here in Utrecht sometime. I can feel it.
Yes, she is, I still call her, she's still alive and kicking for sure. I still call her sometimes for tips because most of the recipes she didn't write. So everything was pretty much looking at what was happening in the kitchen or how and what to harvest for doing what. And I didn't make notes back then. So I only start much later to write down things. And then sometimes I call her and luckily her memory is strong, much stronger than mine, I must say. And then she still gives me tips on, how much salt to put into something, into a vegetable before turning it into a brine or into a sweet and sour or something.
Oh, so, I'm glad your grandma was at least being specific on that because mine would always say, salt, just a little.
Yeah,
but what is a little? Yeah, you know what a little is.
Yeah, it's it's what I call hand and pinch measurements, It's not grams or milliliters. It's like a handful of this, a pinch of that, and then you just smell it, you just look at it. And I'm like, wow, amazing. And this is, I think, the forgotten skill in fermentation. It's more about the doing, the making, so the really hands-on work.
Mm.
the practice of it rather than the recipes, because yeah, we can find everything online, of course, any kind of recipe for kombucha, for example, or for a pickle, but only by making it you really learn how to not master it, but how to customize it to your taste in a way that it's pleasant, gives you satisfaction, and you are gratified and are like, cool, I can share this with my friends without
Cool. So tell us a little bit more about the role of kombucha in the city. What does it mean for the community?
Yes, in the city specifically, I don't really know, because what I've seen with the explosion of kombucha and in general with fermentation revivalism is that there's a lot of people that know more about it, but I don't know how much they practice it at home. But in a broader sense, community-wise, what I see is that it's so precious and so important to share with people that you know or you don't know directly, but you somehow encounter via or whatsoever. It's so important to share cultures, so starters that are also called cultures, and this really builds connection that are beyond just having a drink in a cafe. They are really connection based on nourishment, because we are sharing something that we will then eat, we will then share with other people so that they can also eat and enjoy and be nourished by it. So for me, it's this, let's say, project of the kombucha is involved in some kind of community building, became pretty essential. So now what I do, for example, I keep track as much as possible, not maniacally of course, but I like to keep track of people that are brewing using a SCOBY that came originally from my SCOBY, from my mother, and I kind of trace back or draw a map and routing of the kombucha.
Mm.
So it goes way beyond the city, you know. Right now I think there are some SCOBYs that came from here and are in Sweden, in Switzerland, in Portugal, in Germany, in many places in the Netherlands. So these SCOBYs are traveling, and I try to keep in touch still with these people. Sometimes it's just a WhatsApp picture, because sometimes I ask how is it going, and sometimes it's an email where people ask for a tip or if something goes wrong, and maybe I can help troubleshooting, maybe not, because of course I don't know everything. And some of these people I never met in person, and I yet am connected to them. So it's a way to connect really through just knowledge exchange and nourishment without physically encountering and find out if we can be friends, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a different kind of community connection. And connection, yes.
Yeah. Grace has been organizing a festival which just happened in Utrecht, the Black Earth Festival. I was wondering if there is a relation between your kombucha making and your work in this festival.
Yeah, it's actually a question when you proposed it earlier, I was like, I didn't think that way, because of course we, unless you see whatever you do in your life as a practice with a goal, otherwise it's pretty natural. That's who I am, that's what I do. But then indeed there is a connection, and it's not only that during the festival there are kombuchas brewed for the festival, like we had for example a beer specially brewed for the festival, another fermented drink by the our friends from Boat 122, Carlos and Ilko, but besides this is really this kind of living and working and going through Utrecht community, let's say, across, you know, community building, fermentation and music. So I think Black Earth and Kombucha, one thing they have in common is that both practices are not a solo project, but they are the result of the effort of many people coming together and actually making something happen, something that you enjoy. Doesn't matter if it's a tonic drink or a concert, something that you have a lot of passion for and something that it's not money driven.
I like this idea of collaboration. We were trying to describe the kombucha orchestra.
Yes, yeah, it's because indeed, no, like the kombucha orchestra, and I was just suggesting a reflection about kombucha orchestra and a kombucha ensemble, for example. And it is like, yes, it's not a set given amount of musician or participant or actors joining and playing some standard script, but it's more based on improv and feeling. It could be a bit jazzy or sometimes a very drony ambient kind of sound. It depends which stage of the fermentation you look at. There is always the very free jazz moment of, you know, bubbling, and sometimes, you know, a bottle can explode if you don't pay attention, or and then there is always the slow moments of the sinking SCOBY and very little movement and some creepy hanging yeast filaments that can look scary. So yeah, it's an orchestra that plays a very broad range of soundtracks, let's say.
Cool.
Yes.
Fermentation is a revolutionary act, means reclaiming our food and our participation by becoming producers and creators. It breaks our dependency from the infrastructures of global trade as consumer and user. Fermentation is nourishing and yet preserving cultures, traditions, and bacterial communities inside and outside our body. By perpetrating the vital co-evolutionary process implicated by this relationship, fermentation is the ancient ritual of observation and natural phenomena, and manipulating conditions with trial and error, with the greatest purpose of community and building through food.
I was really hoping we could walk to the storage where you have your project.
Yes, sure, let's do that.
Let's do that.
Kombucha room.
Oh, look at this baby.
Yes.
Can you call them babies or?
Yes, I do. And I usually refer to the SCOBY talking as if they were a she, but well, I guess it's kind of a genderless creature. And this, it's yours.
Oh, oh wow. cute.
Yes. So you will decide if you want to give it a name or something?
We will.
Yeah. And here are just three different jars. As I was saying to you earlier, I had a little accident with my hotel some time ago. And for the first time in 5 years, it molded. And I was trying to brew in a moment that I shouldn't have brewed because I was not very focused, so to speak. And of course, I fucked up the brew. It happens because it's such an unpredictable sometimes process that, you know, you can just pay little attention or less attention than other times, and then something can go wrong. So yes, I had to get rid of my beautiful hotel, which is where usually I keep all the extra scobies to share with people if I give a workshop, or if somebody just asks and give away, or the scobies I use for food, to make candies, or to make some other edibles.
Oh, you can even eat them?
Yes, for sure, yes, yes. It's full of potential. That's why you can get hooked up to kombucha for years, because you keep on discovering new stuff. So it's very rich, very generous. So now I had to start all over a hotel, and here I have an autumn brew. So this will be for drinking. I made it yesterday. It's with fennel, licorice, and cinnamon. So it's very sweet, very earthy, very warming, which is what I seek for in this time of the year when everything gets dark and cold. This is going to be the new mother. So it's brewed with a very simple green tea, gunpowder tea, so without flavor. And I'm just making an extra strong brew to get the scobies thicker. And this, it's a brew I'm making only to produce starter liquid. So I will let this acidify so that when I give away scobies, I have also some liquid to give with it. Otherwise, usually these three jars are producing for drinking, but now I'm working, I'm reworking my brews. And yeah, and here I have some vinegars I've made from kombucha, because of course it naturally turns into a vinegar. So when acetic acids take over, and this is a Queen's vinegar, so it's a mix of kombucha and Queen's, my autumn's favorites. Yeah, this is where they live now in winter. I try to keep them in a room where the temperature is kind of steady, because in our private spaces, by putting the heater on, then you go sometimes to 20 degrees, and maybe at night it's, I don't know, 13 or 10, I don't know, depends where you live. But so in this room, it's...
What is the best temperature to brew?
I think... this is something I feel very similar to the kombucha, and somehow, like, above 20 degrees, it's ideal. You know, I think kombucha is really happy and producing a really good brew if it's between 20 and 24 degrees. It still strives and survives on lower temperature and higher temperatures. But, of course, if the temperature is lower than 20, the brewing time is longer.
You have a scoop it, that's the beginning of it, right?
Yes.
And then?
So you make a sweet tea. So you just make a tea. Of course, there are some proportions to follow, but in general, it's like you make a tea, and then you make it really sweet. And to this sweet tea solution, you add a scoby, possibly a already active scoby, so not very thin, but like 1 centimeter or 0.5 centimeter thick scoby. And then you add, let's say, per 3 liter of tea, one SCOBY and a good glass of starter, which is basically mature kombucha. So it's kombucha from a previous brew that somebody gave to you, and you use that together with the SCOBY as a starter. Yes. So it's pretty simple.
Yeah, you really need a friend to get started.
Exactly, that's the beautiful thing. It's basically, the SCOBY, it's the collaboration, the interaction between the yeast and bacteria. Mm. They work together, so they literally feed on each other waste, because bacteria, yeast eating sugar produce a certain compound, and bacteria eating the compound produced by the yeast turn into something else. And then they start producing this cellulose. It's literally a cellulose that works at the same time as protection to the brew. So it usually floats on top of the brew, sealing it from external contamination and allowing anaerobic process to happen. So there is still oxygen going through, but without contamination. So,
wow. so the
cellulose, it's like yeast and bacteria meeting up and being like, hey, let's do this. Yeah. But, you know, let's do it kind of safe. And then they make...
Like a symbiosis, right?
It's a symbiotic. Yeah, it's a symbiotic relation. Exactly. Technically, it's symbiotic, yes.
And what's in the starter then? What is not in the...
In the starter, what's more developed, there's way more... basically, the sugars are almost all consumed. They already turn into ethanol, but then they transform into acetobacter. So there's a lot of acetic compounds. That's why if you leave it for too long, turns into vinegar. And there are still yeasts. But of course, the sour it gets, the weaker the yeast are, because yeast are kind of party animal. They feed on sugars and they are all like reproducing like crazy. So you really have to learn this rhythm to feed the yeast enough without producing alcohol or producing a very ridiculous amount of alcohol, but keep the yeast alive so that they can perpetuate their work together with the bacteria. Yeah.
So once you start the once you mix the tea with the starter and the SCOBY in a 3-liter jar.
Yes.
How long does it take you for
then you
let it drink it?
Yeah, you let it rest. What I always say, because of course it depends the place, the room where you keep it, if it's a warm place or a cooler place, I always say maybe after 3 days you can already start trying little sips of it. That's why I always suggest a container, a glass container with a spigot, with a tap, so that it's easier to tap some liquid. And then you try after 3 days, after 5 days. The first batches can take up to 10 days. But during summer, maybe in 5 days, it's ready. And when the brew, it's your not first, not second, but third, four times, the... All the creatures, let's say, are well trained, and then they are fit, and every 3 days they are like, "Yes, we are ready. Just
more.
Drink up, yeah, feed us some more." So yes, usually it's tasting, and then between 3 and 10 days it's ready.
Yeah.
And only by tasting, you know when it's okay for you, because you might like it sweeter than, and other people might like it more sour. So. Again, by tasting, you know what's best.
Okay. I hope all the listeners got also as excited as we did. And maybe if they also want to get started with a kombucha, they can contact Grace. How can they contact you? How can they find you? Or
I think the easiest way, what I do, it's mostly telling people to contact me via email or via. So in this case, I guess they will have to contact you guys from the Traveling Farm Museum, and then you can bounce them to me. Or on Instagram, I have an Instagram page, La Cucina Nomade. I'm not super active But I am responsive. But it's mostly via. If you know a way, just get back to me, and I'm more than happy to show how it works and pass some materials and some recipes. And yeah.
Nice. Thank you very much.
No, Grace. Yeah. Thank you. It's I'm happy we are here. The three of us, yeah. Actually the six of us, with the three jars, the vinegars, and the three of us. It's very cozy.
It's very cozy.
Loving it.
You were listening to the Traveling Farm Museum podcast. The Traveling Farm Museum is an initiative of artist collective The Outsiders and Casco Art Institute working for the Commons. With the Traveling Farm Museum, we invite everyone to join us. Come to a workshop, join a tour and discover Leidse Rijn and the surrounding area. We would like to create new stories about this area together with you, neighbors and farmers. These stories are then collected in our Traveling Museum and in our depot. For more information about our meetings, take a look on our website, www.tfmdepot.nl.